Well, I want to start this morning by telling you that I've got something to admit. I told you last week that I was planning on preaching Daniel in what I called episodes, and each chapter is about an episode. I preached chapter one last week. I was planning on preaching chapter two this week, and so forth and so forth. But honestly, I lied. In truth, though, as I reflected on the passage this week, I just got to thinking that if I tried to do all of chapter 2, it would be like squeezing way too much into one sermon. So I spoke with the elders on Monday night, and they said to me, "We're in no hurry. Move at the pace that makes sense." And I greatly appreciated that. So with that said, the plan that I had for the book of Daniel has gone out the window. I don't know what the plan is, but God knows what the plan is. Do you believe that? I believe that. God knows what the plan is, so let's discover his plan together. Well, when I was a kid, I loved the Transformers. Who remembers the Transformers? Oh my goodness, good. You got good memories out there. Awesome. Well, if you ever watched the Transformers or played with Transformer toys, you know that that they were just these cool little robots that changed into cars and jets and different things. And when you purchased a Transformer action figure, not only did you get the cool robot and whatever else came with him, but on the back of the package, there was stats about the robot, like his strength, his speed, all these different things. But the only problem was you couldn't read the stats unless you actually purchased the toy. And then inside the toy, there was this little piece of red film. And see, on the stats, there was this red ink, and you had to lay the red film over the red ink, and then the red would cancel out the red, and then you could see the stats. Now, I know what you're thinking. Why in the world are you talking about this? Well, I'm talking about this because God's ways are often hidden from our eyes. And if we try to understand God's ways, if we try to understand God's message, if we try to understand God through human methods, it's going to be like trying to read the back of that Transformer package without the red strip of film. We need God to understand God. That's the big focus of the message today. We need God to understand God. Now, I told you last week, the book of Daniel has many layers to it. And over the next several chapters, we're going to see Daniel and his friends interacting with King Nebuchadnezzar. And God is going to be working on King Nebuchadnezzar's heart. That's one of the layers here, is that God is working on King Nebuchadnezzar's heart. And King Nebuchadnezzar, remember, is the strongest, greatest, most powerful man at this time. But over the course of chapters 2, 3, and 4, God is going to peel away at Nebuchadnezzar's pride and his arrogance and how he looks to his achievements and who he is and all that he has. God is going to take several chapters, and over the course of those chapters, several years, to peel away at this man's self-reliance and get to his heart. God is working on the heart of Nebuchadnezzar. That's one of the layers here. Another layer that we see here in chapter 2, and this reflects what we learned last week in chapter 1, we see the sovereignty of God. But over the course of the entire chapter, we see specifically the sovereignty of God over history. Now, we're not going to get really to that until next week as we look at the rest of the dream, but here, but the whole theme of chapter 2 really deals with the sovereignty of God over human history. We talked about last week, all things are under God's sovereign control. All things are under God's sovereign control, the major things, the minor things, and the future things. So that theme of God's sovereignty is going to continue in chapter 2. Now, as I alluded to, we're going to break this down a little bit. I'm only going to cover verses 1 through 23 this morning. And what we're going to look at specifically as we look at God's sovereignty, we're going to look at the fact that it is God is the one who reveals. And because God is the one who reveals, then we need God to understand God. Because God has chosen to reveal himself, but he's chosen to reveal himself in such a way that's hidden. And we need God in order to understand what he's revealing. God is sovereign, and he chooses what to reveal. He chooses to whom he reveals, and he chooses when he reveals. But unless we go to God for the understanding, we cannot understand God. We need God to understand God. Nebuchadnezzar has been given a vision of the future, and though he doesn't realize it yet, that's what he's been given, and he needs something. He needs something in order to understand this. So in this passage, what we see here is a very distinct, here's another one of those layers I was talking about, another distinct contrast between Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel. The passage, in fact, as we read it, we're meant to contrast those two people, Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel. Both are looking for meaning. Both approach the vision in their own framework of how to interpret things. Nebuchadnezzar looks to his own methods, whereas Daniel looks to God. Now remember, let's just remind ourselves of the setting. Where are we? We're in Babylon. The exiles of Judah have been taken into captivity. And these royal and noble families, we learned last week, the best looking and the best learned, have been taken into Nebuchadnezzar's royal court to be assimilated in the ways of Babylon. And as we discovered last week, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah flourish. They flourish because God has given them learning and skill. And also, don't forget, God has given to Daniel understanding in all visions and dreams. And that's where we pick up the story. So if you haven't done so already, join me in Daniel chapter 2. And if you're using one of the blue Bibles provided in the seats in front of you, you'll find today's passage on page 737. Daniel chapter 2, verse 1. We're going to break this down as we go over it. Follow along as I read. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Now we're going to stop right there. Sorry to stop you so quick, but we're going to stop right there for a second. I've said this before, but just by way of reminder, ancient peoples did not date things the way we do. We have a standard dating system that we use, whereas in ancient times, you dated events according to the year that corresponded with the ruler. The events that are about to unfold to us happened within Nebuchadnezzar's second year as king. So he hasn't been king very long. And also, if you go back to chapter 1, you'll remember that Daniel and his friends were in training for 3 years. So if you follow the logic, Daniel and his friends have not gone through the complete training yet. They're still in training. The events of chapter 2 happened before the end of chapter 1, chronologically. So Daniel and his friends, they haven't graduated yet. Daniel's still young. His friends are still young. Now let's watch what happens. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. Now I want you to think about that for a minute. Nebuchadnezzar the king, the greatest man, the most powerful man in his day, he was the strongest, he had the strongest empire over the known world. He had conquered so much in such a short time, and he can't sleep at night. He's having dreams, note the plural there, dreams. I believe one dream several times. And by the way, dreams play a huge part in the pagan religion of the time. Dreams in this day and age were considered a method for how the gods would communicate to people. So if a god, a pagan god, wanted to send you a message, one of the ways that they would do that according to Babylonian culture is that they would send you a dream. And the more urgent that the gods were, the more they would send you that dream, which is probably the why the dreams are in plurality. What's probably going on is that Nebuchadnezzar's having one dream and he's having it several times throughout the night. And that would increase his disturbedness. Disturbedness, is that a word? It is now. It would increase his feeling of being disturbed. It increase his urgency here. And if you think about it, if we put ourselves back so many centuries ago, This would kind of make sense. They didn't understand the whole subconscious. They didn't understand the inner workings of the brain and the sleep patterns and all that. So it would make sense for them to think this way, then come to conclusions that dreams must be communications from the otherworldly. That would make sense in their day and age. And yet, interestingly enough, in this instance anyway, Nebuchadnezzar's right. This is the communication from the otherworldly. But not Babylon's gods, from the God, from Yahweh. Look at verse 2. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to him to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. Now these were the Babylonian experts, you could say. They were experts in the supernatural. And by the way, these different terms that we see here, they're not synonyms for the same group of people. Each group here had a speciality. Each group specialized in some form of magic, you could say. The magicians here were actually Egyptian dream interpreters. Babylon utilized Egyptian dream interpreters. That's how big they were into this whole dream thing. And by the way, that word magician there, that's also used. It's the same word in Genesis 41:8, talking about the magicians that Pharaoh used to try to interpret his dreams. There's a lot of similarities here between those two stories. The enchanters mentioned here, they're like exorcists. Okay, their job, once the dream or once the whatever it was communicated, the exorcist's job was to try to defend against bad omens, defend against what might negatively be happening in the kingdom. That was their job. The sorcerers mentioned here, they were the ones who utilized practical magic. They would cast spells and different things like that. And then the Chaldeans, and we saw this word from the last week, it is one of those words that can be used in several different ways. It's used to refer to a specific people group from the southern Babylonian area, but also here, it's referring to what we would call in our day astrologers. So they looked to the stars. So what is the king doing? He's gathering all the experts, different fields, different specialties. He's gathering all together, and this should tell us how troubled he is. He wants to know what his dream or his dreams are all about. You could lose all these different people groups. You could loosely compare them to the many different advisors of a president's cabinet. You know, the president has several different leaders that overlook several different executive departments, and they all come together to advise the president. It's a similar idea there. Verse 3. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show you the interpretation. So the king relates to them, I've had a dream, and their response is, tell us the dream. And note it says, they say to him in Aramaic, which the author's pointing out, that's the language of the realm of the time. So they're saying this in their language. But note quickly what they say, O king, live forever. Now we read that, and you could probably conclude that's one of those terms of respect that you would say to royalty. We might think, you know, long live the king, long live the queen, those kind of things. Here they say something similar, O king, live forever. But that's really interesting, because Nebuchadnezzar's a human like us. There's no chance he's going to live forever. But what's ironic here, if you know the story, the dream that he just got showed him that he wasn't going to live forever. And yet here's his advisors saying, O king, live forever. There's just a bunch of irony right there in those verses. Verse 5, the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. Now, I can imagine if you were standing in that room as Nebuchadnezzar just said these words, you would see a lot of looking around. This was unusual. The fact that a ruler wanted to know what his dream meant, that was common. But the fact that the ruler wanted them to tell him what his dream was, that was unheard of. And the punishment for not getting this right was death. And the reward for getting this right was great. Now, why? Why does the king want them to tell them his dream? Why not follow the normal pattern of things? Well, there's a couple of possibilities. We're not told exactly in the text, but there's a couple possibilities. One, maybe he can't remember the dream. Ever had one of those? Had a dream, woke up, and you're like, what in the world? What was that all about? Or what did I even dream? Maybe he can't even remember it. Maybe he remembers having dreams. He woke up feeling disturbed, but he doesn't remember the actual dream. So he's like, this is significant, but I can't remember what it is, and I need you to tell me what it is. Maybe that's one possibility. But the second possibility is this, and this is the way I tend to think, but again, the scripture doesn't tell us. He could be testing them. Maybe he does remember the dream. Maybe he doesn't want to give it away because he doesn't want them to come up with some sort of meaning that isn't true, just to pacify him. He wants to know the truth. He knows there's something significant about the dream, and he knows that if they're powerful enough to tell him the dream and its interpretation, then he knows he can trust them. But look what they say, verse 7. They answered a second time and said, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show its interpretation." The king answered and said, "I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time, because you see that the word for me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation." So Nebuchadnezzar is taking their request the second time to mean that they're buying time here. They have heard how severe he is, and he's interpreting this as, oh, they're just trying to buy time here. And this kind of supports the idea that he did know his dream, he didn't forget it, but he wants them to tell it to him so he can trust them. But either way, it shows that he doesn't even trust his own men here. What we're starting to see with Nebuchadnezzar, we're starting to see this man spiral out of control. He's becoming unreasonable. But let's give him a little bit of grace here, because ancient kings did have reasons at times to distrust their advisors. There are several stories throughout the Bible and in history where the closest people to the king stage a coup. That is, they plan to overthrow the current leader, they kill him, and then somebody takes his place. In fact, we see this in the Bible, 1 Kings chapter 1. David's son Adonijah attempted to take the throne from his aged father, and that didn't turn out very well for Adonijah, but it happened back then. So we could kind of understand maybe why Nebuchadnezzar's going down this road, but as the story unfolds, he just begins to unravel and unravel and unravel. And he thinks to himself here, you're just trying to buy time, hoping I'll change my mind. That was the whole term, till the times change right there, if that was a little confusing, meaning until I change my mind. You're hoping I'm going to change my mind about this. But he's having none of it. That's why he says, I'm firm on this. But what we see here is a picture of man turning to human wisdom. And where is it leading him? Nowhere. And now he's beginning to spiral out of control. Look at verse 10. It's the Chaldeans' turn to answer. You can imagine the fear they could be feeling at this point. The Chaldeans answer the king and said, "There's not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." Now again, in those two verses, there is a lot of irony, because they are exactly right. And this is one of the points of the whole chapter here. No man can do what the king has demanded. True. No man can tell another person their dream. No one can do this except what they say, the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. And isn't it interesting, although they're pointing to pagan gods, isn't it interesting that they're right, that only God can do the request, or the demand rather, that Nebuchadnezzar is demanding here. Only God is sovereign. Only He is in control. And to relate it to our passage this morning, if we're going to try to figure out what God is doing, we can't go to human wisdom. We've got to go to God. If we go to anything else to try to learn about God, it's going to fail us. But that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar is doing. And then look at verse 12. "Because of this, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that the wise men of Babylon be destroyed." Now, I know it took a long time to get to your first point, but here we are. We're looking at the fact that we need God to understand God. So here's your point. Looking to man's methods to understand God will fail. Looking to man's methods to understand God will fail. Man is completely unable to understand God. Man is completely unable to interpret God on his own. When Nebuchadnezzar can't make sense of God, he turns to the things that he is used to try to understand God. And what happens? We see him spiral out of control. He becomes demanding, he becomes unreasonable, and then he becomes rash. And that's the picture. God has given Nebuchadnezzar a message. Nebuchadnezzar can't make sense of it. He goes to what he knows to try to make sense of it, and he ends up becoming demanding, unreasonable, and rash. He just unravels. And that's what happens when we turn to man's methods to try to understand God. It doesn't work. It doesn't work, and we end up spiraling out of control. Now, I know that the example here from Nebuchadnezzar is extreme. I don't think anyone in this room is spiraling to the point they're ready to kill people. I hope not. But there's a principle here. There is a principle here that when we try to lean upon man's methods for what God is doing, it's going to fail. We are so frail, we are so limited, and we can't make sense of what God is doing. I remember during the year 2020, our favorite year, all the chaos, and there was so much of it, all the chaos that happened throughout that year, the uncertainty, the violence, the fear, and I remember people were losing their heads. I remember like posting or seeing videos posted on Facebook of people sharing their thoughts and their views and everything, what's happening, why it's happening, what we should do about it. And I remember myself thinking, what in the world is going on here? What is God doing? I remember the fear. You remember the fear. And it's during those moments that the world often attempts to make sense of what's going on when God's behind the picture of it all, and we try to make sense of it through human means. We call the experts, survey the people, turn to this leader, turn to that leader, and we as Christians can get caught up in this way of thinking, but it's fruitless, and it's dangerous, because we are unable to make sense of God without God. Man in and of himself is unable to understand God, and that drives him to search for answers that are honestly just laughable. And in some cases, we spiral, as Nebuchadnezzar did. We become completely irrational. We have a tendency to rely on anything other than God. Here's the truth. Nebuchadnezzar was king overall. He was the most powerful man on earth. And one dream, or possibly the same dream over and over, shook him up. It shook him up, and when he looked to the experts to make sense of things, he went from bad to worse and spiraled out of control. Now let's think about our lives. Have you ever been trying to make sense of what God is doing, but you're using human means to do so? The king has a sleepless night. Can anyone relate to that? A sleepless night because of everything that's going on. I had a sleepless night one night many years ago. I'd been working at a job, and because of economy and the way things were, I got laid off and didn't know it till that day that it happened. And I have to tell you, I went home that night. My wife and I prayed together. I went to bed. It was a sleepless night. What's going to happen? And it's our tendency in those moments to turn to worldly things. And in one way I did. I don't want to say completely. I did, of course, turn to the Lord. But in some ways, I wanted to fix the problem. Write up resumes, go get a job, here and now, let's do this. Not that that's a bad thing. But when we trust in the worldly things, we just move from bad to worse. When we try to figure out God in the framework of human reasoning, it's going to fail. Why? Isaiah 55, 8 to 9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. God is beyond us, and using man's methods to understand God will fail. But there's another direction we can go. We can turn to man's methods to try to understand God, and we're just going to end up frustrated at least, or spiraling out of control at worst. But there's another way. There's another thing we can depend on. Let's read on. Go to verse 13. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. So note this. Nebuchadnezzar has spiraled so far out of control that he's not just going to kill his advisors. He's going to kill all the students. Remember, Daniel and his friends, they're still in training at this. But he's just going to kill. He's gone so far out of control. He's just going to kill them all. And you can imagine the soldiers running from place to place, wherever they are, just grabbing people, rounding people up. It's a bad day to be a wise man. Then we get to verse 14. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. Now look at that for just a second. Daniel, it says, replied with prudence and discretion. Would you? Would I? I mean, we get the sense that Arioch, this captain here, is going around, he's collecting all the wise men, and it's probably not happening nicely. It's probably happening roughly, but Daniel responds with prudence and discretion, and those words communicate counsel and understanding. In other words, what the author's saying here is Daniel keeps his head. As people are being grabbed, as people are being rounded up, Daniel is as cool as a cucumber. And to be cool as cucumber, cucumbers have to be kept in the fridge, but that's regardless. He's cool as a cucumber. And what we're seeing here, and what the author wants to point out here, is the contrast between a raging king spiraling out of control and a young teenage boy, you could call him a slave, that's just as cool as can be. We're meant to see that contrast. The king can't sleep at night. The greatest, strongest, most powerful man in the world can't sleep at night because of troubling dreams. But Daniel remains cool under pressure. And at this point in the story, Daniel's just trying to get to the bottom of things. He goes to Arioch, this captain, and he's asking, what's going on here? Actually, I jumped ahead of myself. I'm sorry. Back up one second. He goes to Arioch. And by the way, this Arioch, he's called captain of the king's guard. And that's a similar title to Potiphar from Genesis 39. Remember Potiphar, who was had the similar position in Pharaoh's cabinet. That's where Joseph went to be a slave of Potiphar. And so like I said, there's many similarities here. Potiphar also knew someone who was good at interpreting dreams. We're meant to see this connection to Joseph. We get to verse 15, and Daniel declares to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree of the king so urgent?" Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation of the dream. So again, level-headed Daniel, boldly speaking to this captain here, boldly speaking to his would-be killer, goes to try to find out what's going on. And then we're not told exactly what happens here, but somehow Daniel sets up an appointment with the king. I can imagine that's not an easy thing to do, but he does it. And we're not told all the details, but Daniel did what the Chaldeans couldn't do. Daniel buys some time. And by the way, we get the sense here, Arioch makes the matter known to Daniel. I imagine captain of the king's guards aren't keen on just describing everything to those they're about to kill. You get the sense here that Arioch doesn't want to do this, but he's following orders. And it says in verse 17, Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Do you see the contrast there? Who did Nebuchadnezzar go to? He went to men of earth. Who is Daniel and his friends going to? The God of heaven. They get together and they pray. Right response. And twice, by the way, that term God of heaven is used in this passage. It's used again in verse 19. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel recognizes something Nebuchadnezzar doesn't. Daniel recognizes that he needs God to understand God. Nebuchadnezzar is all out of control. Daniel is here at peace. Daniel is calm through this whole exchange, even though his life is on the line. See, the big thing that troubled the king caused the king to trouble everybody. But Daniel, under threat of death, does what he should do. He goes to seek God so that he can understand God. It says, and I think this is funny, maybe even meant to be ironic, it says that God revealed to Daniel a vision of the night. Of the night. The king can't sleep at night. Daniel's getting all his information that he needs at night. Daniel seeks the Lord and receives in the night exactly what he needs. And then we find what comes from this. Not just peace, but praise. Look at verse 20. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness and in the light, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise. For you have given me wisdom and might, and you have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter." I told you last week, the book of Daniel, for the first half anyway, the literary genre is narrative. We're being told stories, and these are the great stories that we remember from Sunday school that we love to talk about. But within this narrative, we get to the end of the prayer time with Daniel and his friends, and Daniel breaks out into to poetry, you could say, to song almost. He sings praise to God here. And whenever that happens, notice there's so many details we don't get. Like how did Daniel get an audience with the king? We don't know that. But the author seeks to give us this detail, this song. That means we should look at it. And the interesting thing, what we see in this song is we see characteristics of the sovereignty of God that contrast the inability of the magicians and the sorcerers and the enchanters and the Chaldeans. We see truth compared to falsehood. Daniel says, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom brings wisdom and might." That is, God is strong. God has wisdom. God is the one to interpret God. We need God to understand God. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. And again, we go back to what we learned from chapter 1. It is God who is controlling all of what is happening in the world. It is God who set up Nebuchadnezzar. It is God who allowed Judah to fall. God is sovereign. Verse 22, He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with Him. It is God who reveals. God knows all, and God reveals to whom God desires to reveal to. So he says in verse 23, "To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might, and have made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter." And what I love about that is that Daniel chooses to highlight that it's God that's done this. God has revealed to Daniel. And we're going to pick up more of this theme next time. But God is the one who's opened up the truth to Daniel. When we choose to go to God to understand God, then we're going to be astonished at how He works. And the result is praise to God. So the whole point here is that when we go to man's methods to try to understand God, it's going to fail. But when we go to God to understand God, it's going to succeed. I want to give you your second point, but I don't see it in my notes. And I don't know why that is. So I'm going to look up on the screen. What's the second point? Looking to God to understand God will result in peace and praise. That's your second point. Looking to God to understand God will result in peace and praise. When we look to God to understand Him, we're going to end up in the same place Daniel is. Now, let me just be clear about something, okay? I don't want you to get the idea that if we're confused about something going on and we turn to God, he's just going to reveal everything to us. That's not what I'm saying. Yes, that happened in Daniel's matter. But there will be times when we were faced with things that things in our life that we cannot understand. And there are times we will go to God as we should for wisdom and help and understanding, but still feel left in the dark. Just because we go to God doesn't mean he's going to reveal everything. And that's not the point I'm trying to make, but what I am trying to make is this point. When we are trying to go to God to understand God, it's going to result in peace. It's going to result in praise, even if we've got it figured out or not. Putting our faith in sovereign God who holds all things together results in peace and praise. So let me drive this home for us. What do you look to when God doesn't make sense? What do you look to when God doesn't make sense? Where do you turn? How do you try to make sense of this life? Are you trusting in things? Are you trusting in man-centered things other than God? And to figure that out, the question to ask yourself is this: where do I run when life doesn't make sense? What do I put my trust in? Do I put my trust in substance? Do I put my trust in the books that I've read? Do I put my trust in this person? Do I put my trust in that person? Where do I run when life seems to be falling apart? And if the answer is not God, then you're running to some sort of man-made method to try to figure this out. When the truth is, we need God to understand God. Only God knows what God is doing, and so only God holds the answers that we're looking for, but God will choose what and when to reveal whatever he decides to reveal. What God simply wants from you, what God simply wants from me, is to trust and rely on him. Isn't it interesting? Let's stop and think about this for a second. Isn't it interesting what's going on here? Why does God use a dream? Why doesn't God simply communicate to Nebuchadnezzar? Why doesn't God just simply make it clear? Why doesn't God just reveal himself to Nebuchadnezzar and just tell him what the dream is all about? Or forget the dream, just tell him plainly the message God wants to reveal to him. God could have simply done that, but he doesn't. He gives him this confusing dream that he can't figure out. Why did he do that? He did that because, remember, he's peeling away at Nebuchadnezzar's heart. He did that to show him the futility of the wisdom of man. God wanted Nebuchadnezzar to see that it is God he needs, not man's futile wisdom. And the same is true with us. God doesn't just come right out and explain everything he does because he wants us to come to him. He wants us to see that it's him that we need, not earthly man-made methods in this life. We just need to understand God. And ultimately, when we understand God, ultimately the way to understand God is through his son. In John 14, 8 and 9, Jesus is responding to Philip. It says, Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us. Jesus said to him, have I been with you so long, and you still do not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Jesus is the great revealer. Jesus is God who shows us God. God reveals God. We need God to understand God, and Jesus is the ultimate revelation. Colossians 1:15, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. John 1:18, no one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He, Jesus, has made him known. What I'm driving at here is this. No amount of human understanding will bring us closer to God. We need God to understand God. And who reveals God best? Jesus Christ. Jesus is the one by which we come to fully know God. So when we come to Christ, when our lives are oriented around Christ, when he, not man, is the one that we're running to, then the end result is going to be peace and praise. Christ, you could say, is the little strip of red film that we need to reveal God to us. And then we come to a place of peace and praise. Will you pray with me? Jesus, thank you so much for who you are and for all that you do. You died for us. You rose for us. You conquered sin. You conquered death. But you also reveal the Father. God, you are the one that we need to know and to understand and to draw close to God. Jesus, again, I just want to say we need you. I thank you for who you are. I thank you for all that you are doing and all that you are. Continue to reveal the Father to us, we pray in your awesome name. Amen.